saw Phantom of the Opera on Broadway. Mm. It was the first legit Broadway big show I had ever seen. And the level, and I can picture where I was sitting. I was in the third or fourth row of the mezzanine of the Majestic Theater, house left. And I remember just like the opulence of this show. Right there in that moment, I was like, I have to do this.
Hey there. Welcome to Lessons in Creativity, where we'll explore the creative process across different disciplines and learn how to harness this natural part of our human experience. I'm Jenna Massey, your fellow student and host. This episode is with Jeff Metzler. Jeff started his career as a Broadway performer, appearing in 2 Tony-winning shows, 3 award-winning national tours, and on live television. He eventually transitioned from being a performer to working on the business side of Broadway, and then into the world of consulting. Jeff talks about the opportunities and challenges between the worlds of creativity and business, and he shares some interesting thoughts about how to foster a creative culture in the corporate world. I hope you enjoy our conversation. Welcome, Jeff.
I'm thrilled to be in Hoboken.
I'm so excited to have you here to talk all about Broadway and your creative disciplines, consulting. I would love to start with thinking about Jeff, age 7, 8, 9, and thinking about in what ways creativity came out around that time.
2 things stand out in my head. One was I got my hand on some paints, and one weekend I probably was like 9 or 10. I was in my room and I had this mug with Steamboat Willie on it, the Mickey Mouse, is black and white. And for some reason, I sat in my closet and decided to blow it up to 3 feet its size. And I'm like sitting in my closet painting, you know, scaling this thing up and painting this sitting inside my closet, which, I mean, I was inside the closet in many ways at that point. But, you know, I did it secretly as if I didn't want my mom to know, which was just totally weird. But bless that little, you know, kid's heart for doing that. My mom did find out and she would brag to everyone about it. I don't know why. Weird thing. But the other side of it was creativity manifests itself across a lot of different dimensions, in that I wanted to create things myself, create entertainment. I wanted to create a stage. So my parents got rid of this curtain, like with a pulley, blinds. And I ripped off all the blinds and I attached a sheet and then I mounted it to the ceiling in our basement and then created like a little like stage, like a little puppet stage. And then I rigged hooks to the seat, to the ceiling, and strings, and painted sets on different sets on cardboard is the Wizard of Oz. So I had an Emerald City, all this stuff, you know, and connected it so that I could pull them up and down like a legit theater. Mm-hmm. And then, you know, on stage, there's at the time, and if you remember your middle school or auditorium, there's the strip of lights above your head, and there were the clear lights, the red lights, and the blue lights. Mm-hmm. So I found light bulbs and there was some spray paint. And so I spray painted one of the light bulbs blue, another one red. And so that I could create and control the type of color that was shaping the mood of whatever the story was. And then I tortured my brother to, you know, be a part of my puppet show. But looking back at that, I'm like, not only was I doing like the, what everyone thinks of as creative, which is artistic, but also come up with these really creative solutions to make something happen, given the constraints of I didn't have money. I didn't have anyone like saying, Jeff, do this for us. I had a basement with a bunch of abandoned stuff and, you know, coming up with how do I make this happen? So, yeah.
This other world that you really created.
Yeah. And I didn't feel like I had any friends at that time. And so it was a place where I could feel a sense of like euphoria and excitement. Mm-hmm. And yeah, it made me happy. Yeah. Made me excited.
I love that. So how did you get from there to Broadway?
Easy. Before I got into high school, I saw Phantom of the Opera on Broadway. Mm. It was the first legit Broadway big show I had ever seen. And the level, and I can picture where I was sitting. I was in the third or fourth row of the mezzanine of the Majestic Theater, house left. And I remember just like the opulence of this show, the patterns and the textures and the layers of the drapes and the curtains and even things like the wigs, how detailed and perfect they were, and these voices that were, you know, just extraordinary. And that right there in that moment, I was like, I have to do this. I have to do this. This is amazing. And so I then leaned into that, which I became more serious in the shows I did at school. I did community theater productions. I went to school my freshman year at the University of the Arts in Philadelphia for musical theater. I actually transferred to the Boston Conservatory my sophomore year, which at the time was like the second most competitive school in the country. I did what most people do, you know, moved to New York with a suitcase and a dream and auditioned as much as I could. I got my first national tour within, it was Fosse, the national tour of Fosse, I think within a year of moving to New York. And when I got back from that, I was only out there for 6 months before it closed. I got the national tour of 42nd Street about 3 or 4 months after that, which in between both of those phases, I thought, I'm never going to work again. You know, yeah. Everyone else is getting more jobs than me. No, not true. And did a bunch of other work before about, it was 2007, I got cast in Mary Poppins on Broadway. So a lot of, how did I get there? A lot of determination, practicing, a level of brand visibility, putting yourself out there enough that casting directors know who you are mm-hmm. and get a sense of who you are and what you're good at. So they then, you know, push for you or even just kind of give a call out that, oh, we should look at this guy. So,
yeah. Wow. That's what a journey. I mean, it's like you were doing this your whole life since childhood and continuously practicing and finally resulting in actually being on Broadway.
Yeah. Yeah. And that's what it was. It was just play for me in middle school and high school, yeah. but really it was practice,
yeah.
you know,
yeah.
getting reps in so that when the time came, I had done it in so many different versions, iterations that rehearsing for my first Broadway show, like the thought of doing that 8-10 years prior was like, oh my God, what must that be like? And terrifying to me. But by the time the time came, it was just rehearsing for another show.
Mm, wow.
You know?
Yeah. So how did your time on Broadway shape your view of creativity?
I'd say there's three kind of key elements to that. There's that experience shaped my view on creativity through the lens of excellence, agility, and collaboration.
Mm-hmm.
On the excellence side of things, just as my little 12, 13-year-old self watching The Phantom of the Opera was just enamored by the level of detail and artistry, being a part of that, both the costumes I wore and seeing up close the details, them all, the sets, the lighting design, and being privy to the process of those artists and how they created it, and how you know, just detail they were and in pursuit of the right fit for all of them. But on my side as the performer, talk about rehearsal, just rehearsal on overdrive, doing numbers over and over and over and over again. And as you know, for me, I'm just naturally lazy. I'd rather lay on the couch watching TV. But so to be asked to do a number over and over again, that in my head, I'm like, it's good. We're good, right? Why are we doing this again?
Mm-hmm.
But to have the choreographer ask you to do it again and every time give you a new note mm-hmm. or critique something you're doing. And, you know, like when I was doing Radio, I did the Radio City Christmas Spectacular, and there was this number where our hands are, you know, if you spread your hand out like a jazz hand. And I kept getting this note about my hand that it wasn't like splayed wide enough. And I was just like, you're kidding me. And another note that like, your eye is looking slightly to the left. It can be just a little bit
wow.
more to the right. I'm like,
it's
are you kidding me?
How precise.
Crazy or amazing, I'm not sure. But it teaches you that discipline of that, like, the details matter
yeah.
and repetition matters. And why not challenge it to the extreme? Because you can always bring it back and say, hey, let's relax it and make it a little bit more chill and organic. Mm-hmm. But that excellence component of and learning what true excellence looks like, which also comes from when you rehearse a Broadway show or really any show, throughout, once you go into dress rehearsals, you're doing the show over and over again without an audience. The audience is the director and the choreographer, and they're sitting there out in the house with a notepad. And at the end of the run through, the whole cast comes, sits out in the house. The director and choreographer stand at the front, and for probably an hour and a half, go line by line saying, Jenna, you weren't on the right you weren't in the right place for this number. Jenna, raise your hand about 6 inches during this moment, giving like every single person note after note, and which could be a brutal thing to receive that level of scrutiny, but it's practiced. You know to expect it every night.
Yeah.
And so it's not a big deal.
Yeah.
Just like in relationships. Like if you're giving your partner regularly having conversations about what you need or things that may not be working for you, then it's not unexpected. And it's just an ongoing conversation. Mm-hmm. Now, if the director never did that, and then one day they showed up and they just gave me, you know, 2 pages full of critique, it'd be pretty brutal. So there's that part of excellence. On the agility side of things, I really learned that maintaining a position of agility for as long as possible is so important when trying to create something meaningful creatively. An example would be a lot of Broadway shows that I see. I can't help but wonder, based off of my experience of shows I've been a part of, they jumped into things a little too quickly in terms of capital investments on costumes and sets and green lighting things before they really understood the why of the entire show or the why of their vision. And then you're stuck with, let's say there's some big production number, a big flashy dancy number with 25 chorus people on, dancers on stage, all with their own costume that probably costs a minimum of $3,000 to $5,000, you know, do the math, but then add on top of it the number of hours they spent rehearsing it and what that costs for those performers, and also the time then lost not putting it to another side of the show. And then also the what was spent on the set, which for that scene may be hundreds of thousands of dollars. And then you realize that it doesn't work. It's, you know, or it's slowing down the show, or that it just doesn't add anything.
Wow.
But here you are out of town trying out the show, or you've brought it to New York. And I don't think a lot of people in that industry understand the concept of sunk cost. That, yeah, you can hold on to that number that in total costs you $1 million, but it's actually going to sink the ship because it's slowing it down. And it's going to be one of several factors that make people go, eh.
Yeah.
Ugh, you know.
Wow, it's so interesting, especially coming with a business mind, looking at this, because it's so parallel to a lot of startups and putting so much money in up front before really knowing is there a product market fit.
Yeah, yeah. But also in the business world, you learn about agile, but this is just being an artist.
Right.
You know, coming up with a sketch, trying it out, you know, throwing it away, coming up with a new version. You like the new version, but you keep refining it, editing it, showing it to an artist friend to be like, what do you think? Them giving a critique or a note, and then continuing to refine it. That's the same way a Broadway show works, you know? So agile, the importance of agile and remaining as agile as possible for as long as possible. What is the MVP? Mm-hmm. How do you stay in that kind of prototyping phase, you know, as long as possible, so you're not burdened by money and investment,
right?
So you can really do what's best and what's right for whatever the output is. And the collaboration piece, I think the biggest aha was that growing up in theater and doing it in college or regional stuff, I was always the first person to do that production in that location. You know, when I did Chicago at Merry-Go-Round Playhouse, that was the first time we did it there. So I was a part of creating it and was able to say, what if we did this? Or the choreographer saying, come up with something for these 8 counts. Mm-hmm. Broadway, however, I didn't realize that it is a product once a show opens. Mm-hmm. So just like the iPod 10 needs to be the same on the day that it's launched as the day before they go into the next generation, the product has to remain consistent. The same is true for Broadway, right? Hamilton on opening night, the show that's reviewed, that is everyone raves about and everyone, you know, hears about and then wants to see, has to be the same as Hamilton that's now almost 10 years old, if you can believe it, I think. Yeah, I believe it's almost 10 years old. You know, the show is the same, more or less, and it has to, it becomes a product. Mm-hmm. And so as a performer in a show, someone who's used to constantly creating and coming up with different things and trying things and being able to play, the realization that you're no longer really a collaborator and you're more of a wheel, a cog in a wheel of a machine, that was really interesting and became quite challenging for me that, you know, 2.5 years into doing Mary Poppins, in order for this machine to work properly, because in reality, Broadway shows operate just like the assembly line at a Ford car factory. And in fact, I brought this up to our operations teacher that, you know, when performers come off stage and have a quick change, you have to go to the exact same spot backstage where your dresser is waiting for you and your shoes are in the exact same place and the basket where your new costume is in the exact same place. And you have to discard the costume you're wearing in the same order that night as you did the 300 nights before you in order for the dresser to then hand you, you know, the new set of pants without discombobulating everything and then potentially throwing off everything else. So this realization that it's more about maintaining the product more than it is about collaborating. And, you know, that was a hard lesson to swallow. And then how do you keep it interesting and fun when you're literally doing the same thing every single night? And the reality is most people don't see this, I hope, but there's a lot of play on stage and Broadway shows that the audience doesn't see for us to keep it interesting for ourselves, which for better or worse, we do it. We probably shouldn't, but I don't know, maybe it creates some play and for the audience as well. But, you know, like in Radio City, when I was dressed up as a big white polar bear for the Nutcracker sequence where the Rockettes changed. And we had already done it, you know, 100-some times and, you know, 4 times a day. And so we would come up with themes, you know. And so one day for polar bears, we'd be like, all right, well, let's play cops and robbers. And the polar bears on stage left will be the cops and the polar bears on the stage will be the robbers. And you're maintaining the choreography. You're doing the same everything the choreographer asks you to do, but you're adding a little like body movements or looking over at the other person and creating some sort of little gesture.
Secret of,
yeah, exactly. So, yeah.
I mean, it's really interesting how you describe the difference between, you know, pre-show and post-show and that being a product.
Yeah.
And even just thinking back to what you described as a child, creating the whole set, creating like all the characters, like having much more of a big picture. And then you're kind of then playing this role where you're every night doing the same exact thing in the same exact way.
Yeah.
And I can imagine that, yeah, that does feel like you're not able to express yourself as creatively.
Yeah. And you just put beautifully what I've been trying to articulate. And actually, I didn't really think about it that way, that as a child, the thing that got me so excited about this industry and doing this work was what you just said, that I was like a multi-hatter. I was wearing so many different hats and I had so much, I was able to set the vision. I was able to pull all the strings to make the difference happen, to bring in all the different elements. And what's more creative than that? And I went from this like really broad, wide thing with a lot of control over how it came out to being literally the paintbrush, not even the paint itself. I was just the paintbrush. Somebody else was the paint. Someone else was the, you know.
But I also love that you add in these moments of play, because that's such a good lesson for really anything as well that you're doing, and even prevents your brain from going on autopilot, right? So even they say sometimes take a different route to walk to work in the morning, and that changes up the default thinking that your brain tends to do.
Yeah.
So it's you guys playing and keeping it interesting is like your way of doing that and kind of finding that. You might have even found new discoveries in doing things that way.
Yeah, that's a great point. And actually, we did. Like, I remember when I would do supercalifragilisticexpialidocious and Mary Poppins, and there were nights when a few of us, before we'd go on stage, you'd be like, all right, what's our motivation tonight? And we'd be like, what if we're all different animals? Choose your animal. And it wasn't to go on stage and start crawling around like an animal, but how can you, as a human in the scene, take on the characteristics of the animal you choose, right?
Yeah.
So if I choose I'm going to be a squirrel tonight. You know, you think about like in Harry Potter, the guy who like Wormtail or whatever his name is, he's very squirrely in nature. Like for all we know, maybe that was in his head. Or if I go on that night, I'm like, okay, I'm going to be a giraffe. You just carry yourself a little bit more regally. And the creative part of that is then, you know, the landscape. And so how do you infuse your walk across that landscape with these different inputs and inspirations? So absolutely.
Yeah. And the practice is what enables you the ability to play, right?
Yes.
You've got this rote in you.
Yeah. Which is why a lot of people in the business world, when they go, they have to make some sort of speech or something like that, and they get all nervous and they see other people who are executing it so flawlessly and off, seemingly off the cuff. It's Broadway. You feel just as nervous on the first night that you have to do a Broadway show in front of anybody new, like in the rehearsal room, because it's just not in your bones yet. And it's probably feels a little bit uncomfortable because it's not in your bones yet. And you're thinking so hard about every single move. Whereas once you get to that place that it's just muscle memory, your mind can then go into all these different directions and add all these other layers for better or worse.
Yeah.
And it takes effort to constantly check yourself to be like, no, be present.
Yeah.
And you owe it to your young self who saw Phantom of the Opera.
Right.
You owe it to every person in the audience who's seeing a Broadway show for the first time or for the last time. Or for that person who's coming to a Broadway show that, for all you know, maybe they just lost somebody. Maybe they just had the worst day ever at work. Or maybe they've never seen a character in the real world like the character you're presenting on stage.
Yeah.
And it's an opportunity to open up their mind and see, you know, create... plant more seeds of empathy within them.
Yeah.
So
yeah,
it's an important job in a lot of ways.
I think it's also just so interesting hearing you talk about it and knowing you in like more of the business setting as well, you know, especially because knowing you, you are so attentive to detail and experience. And I really feel like you got that from Broadway and were able to translate that into the business world.
Yeah.
But I'm curious if you could talk a little bit about, okay, moving from Broadway to the business world, like, what was that transition like, and what did you kind of take, what were some of the lessons that you took from your experience?
So the first job I had that lasted for a while was, which was a few years after I left performing, was at the Walt Disney Company, Disney Theatrical Group, which was actually the corporate producing arm of Mary Poppins, my first Broadway show. So it was really cool to be able to go from this backstage, on stage, the product, the art, mm-hmm. to then going into the office, which poetically was actually upstairs at the New Amsterdam Theater, made my Broadway debut downstairs. And then a few years later, you know, started my corporate, you know, or this other part of the career upstairs. So the interesting thing was that I went from being the paintbrush to, again, expanding into a place that had more creative opportunity. I was working in production operations, which is the part of the company that keeps the Lion King running, scales the Lion King around the world, or Aladdin, or Newsies, or any number of these shows. And as I looked across the landscape of the company and how many shows we were going to be opening in that coming year, we were, you know, Lion King was turning 20. We were opening a new tour of Lion King, and there were already like 12 companies of the Lion King open around the world. We were opening the Aladdin National Tour. We were bringing Newsies to filming it for Netflix, all these things. And I thought there's going to be so many different functions around each of these openings that's going to need somebody. Currently, it's just kind of a person from here or there grabbing it. But what if I became the creative director or the kind of the manager, the driver, the owner of all these brand experiences? So pitched a role and did exactly that. I was the creative director for all of these things, came up with the concepts, and also found opportunities to take things like parties, you know, Frozen opening on night on Broadway, traditional on Broadway, it's throw a gobo up on the wall with the logo, invite people, have drinks, have fun. But instead, how do we actually turn this into a marketing opportunity, a way to further tell the world that they should come see this? Mm-hmm. A challenge with Frozen was it wasn't too far after the film had come out. So still there was a lot of association with it being a children's thing, this kiddie cartoon. But the ticket price for a Broadway show is far more expensive. And you also want couples or adults to come see the show. So how do you, we designed the show in a way that was more elevated and sophisticated and deserving of a Broadway audience, but you're still fighting against that public perception. So for me, how do we use the opening night party as an opportunity to further give the public a reason to lean in and say, what are they doing over there? Oh, that's interesting. I didn't expect that. Oh, this must not be the same thing as the cartoon. Just like the Lion King is so much more elevated than the Lion King Broadway is so much more elevated than the cartoon. You know, that was the approach with Frozen. So for the opening night party, creating a bunch of different activations, how do we make sure it's as Instagrammable as possible, all these moments of surprise and delight so that people are posting it and it's getting out to the world, but also hosting it at a venue that's totally unexpected. It was at Terminal 5, which is a, you know, a emo rock venue, redoing the space, turning all the branding to make it feel like it worked in that space, turning it all neon and all these different touches that in the end, we did exactly what we set out to do. And, you know, we got written up in Vogue and for the party that really did say, oh, this is interesting. This is not your children's Frozen. So,
It's the experience design that you is so naturally ingrained in you and you do so well and you light up. And I think it's as a form of creativity, it's an expression of these plays, but I've also seen you do it where it's like really an expression of you in the experience that you're putting together.
Yeah. That's an important part of it that was meaningful for me is that it was an expression of me and that I had been to those parties on the other side as a performer. And so now I was able to bring this other level of like how important those nights are for them, but how exciting they are for other people as well. Mm-hmm. I was able to bring in the visual, creative, artistic design side to the environment. I was able to bring in the story and performance element in terms of what's the entertainment, the vibe, the feeling of the space, just, you know, a performance. But then, you know, as a performer, you're jerked around a lot by producers. And so it just has made me very thoughtful over the years of how I treat people and how do you make people feel seen and special. So also how do we design this so it's really user friendly, but also makes everyone feel special. This night wasn't just designed by, you know, this, we didn't just pick a venue and throw some catering out there, but we actually thought a lot about who is showing up to make it feel like a celebration of each person's unique input to it. So that was a great experience. I went to business school because I had all these creative instincts and these cool ways to activate things, but I felt limited in terms of just my business sense. How do I further justify why we should have to do certain creative things or enhance things in certain ways? How do we maximize the value created through creative endeavors? So I went to business school, went to Deloitte afterwards in consulting, which was really interesting because in a lot of, I think my creative background is something that in interviews, people not from that world go, oh, wow, cool, fun. And part of that, not the only reason, but part of perhaps why I got the job was like, oh, great, we like people that think differently. Let's bring them inside. But then you get inside and the Walt Disney Company at the core, its mission, that creativity is a part of the fabric of its heritage and its mission.
Yeah.
And Deloitte, not to say they don't do cool, innovative stuff. That's not it at all. And it's a fantastic company, but it's just not a priority of the company, right? The priority is how do we maximize and create value for ourselves and for our clients? So creativity takes discipline and practice. Trying things out, it not working and being okay with that.
Mm-hmm.
And in at a firm where it's really all their like risk audit advisory is a big part of it.
Yeah.
You know, the appetite's not there. And also with people perhaps that aren't as passionate about the arts and creativity, they don't realize the value of kind of surprise and delight moments in the most unexpected places that might make a client go, oh, that's thoughtful, or that energizes me and it excites me.
Yeah.
So working in a place where the passion for the creativity or even the realization of the value of it, of how it can move people and how that can create a lot of value and opportunity is challenging.
It's really interesting on that point because I think there's so much that goes into experiences of interacting with a client, and to your point, the value is sometimes intangible.
Yeah.
But it does go far when you're able to establish more trust. You're able to establish a deeper relationship.
Yeah.
You're able to delight someone or make them feel something.
Yeah.
But it's hard to be quantified and hard to have that understood right away until you see it in the form of follow-on work and wins and revenue. And
Yeah. Like I worked in this part of the company where we did, at Deloitte, where we did these immersive strategy experiences with clients. And you know, we only had, you know, 6 weeks or so while working on multiple projects concurrently to create these things. And the desire was for it to be this immersive, creative, business not as usual experience, which a lot of ways it was, you know, not what people experience on a daily basis. But this expectation of make it crazy, wild, fun, zany, make it something really surprising and different. But it was like limited time. There's no budget. And you need time or budget.
Yeah.
You know, you can get really creative if you have time. You can get really creative if you have budget. But, yeah. You know, and also or the appetite for, you know, or that it's a part of the mandate that it has to be. Or the appetite, you know. So that was challenging. And I did what I could to do things that were unexpected or thoughtful. But it's just a different appetite. And that's a challenging thing to go from the Walt Disney Company where everyone is very excited about how, you know, how beautiful or moving or whatever it could be to Deloitte where people don't understand that it has to be a part of the process the whole time. It has to be valued.
Yeah.
It's not just a cherry on top. Mm-hmm. And you have to trust. You have to trust it. Too. You have to trust that people will be moved by things.
Yeah, you can't let too much fear creep in.
Yeah.
You literally can't be afraid and curious at the same time. It doesn't work in our brains that way.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And the other part is like the practice. If you don't practice creativity or you don't have a culture of creativity where, you know, like one time I was in this strategy session with a lot of really senior execs and they were tasked with, you know, we have an opportunity coming up. We currently have an offering that is A, but let's innovate. Let's change it. Let's make sure it continues to be, you know, the leader in the marketplace. You know, let's come up with crazy things. And, you know, I designed this strategy session for them, but I found that there was so much time spent defending why what already exists is fantastic, which it was. But Steve Jobs didn't stop at the iPhone 1, right? He had that growth mindset that like, how much cooler could we? He had that what if and the yes and mindset. And, you know, there wasn't, but it had been practiced to always ask yourself the question, but what if we also did this or that? Or this sounds crazy, but what if it was possible? That wasn't practiced. So I think it was really challenging for that group to do it.
No, you're making me think about environment is so important with creativity. And also this concept that you're hinting at, which is like this creativity barometer. Because I found that in certain settings, I'll go in a community of songwriters and I'm the absolute least creative person in comparison to them. But then in the business world, certain settings of the business world, there's things that I can bring there. But where does that really stack up?
I had two big realizations from that day. One, which was we then moved into a part of the afternoon, which was like prototyping, where the task was come up with something wild and crazy and outer space level wild, and then we'll bring it back down to earth and figure out what's doable. They couldn't do that. Mm. So the takeaway for me, though, was that one, oh, wow, Jeff, here are really senior, impressive, accomplished, great leaders and professionals, but it's not easy for them to think the way you think. I was like, oh, wow, that's a special skill of mine, you know? So that's one thing. But the other thing, which is the other realization takeaway, which connects to what you were saying, is like creating the culture and the conditions for creativity are so important. Mm-hmm. And one of the things there is creating safety for creativity, that like safety and incentives together are really important, right? If it's something that somebody's already uncomfortable at doing because it's not practiced, they need to feel incentivized for like, why do I want to put myself out there on the limb and say something that could be rejected or sound silly or wild, especially given that I don't have that brand in the company, you know, as the finance guy or whatever. And then, so what's incentivizing me to want to take that risk? And then also what's like the safety knowing that it's going to be that it's actually, you know, that I'm not going to be penalized.
You're going to be supported.
Yeah, I'm going to be supported. It's got to be the safe space that there's either an incentive that you'll be rewarded for failure even. Yeah. That if you take a calculated risk and an idea, actually, let's celebrate that. That's all. Trying something different is always a win.
It's so interesting because in writing and any kind of creative act, there's this understanding like you're going to write a lot of bad songs, bad stories before you actually get good at it. And I think in the corporate world, there's this fail fast or fail acceptance mindset. But in practice, it's really challenging to actually stick to that. And also, what does that mean in a corporate setting? So it's hard to actually create the space and the time for the necessary practice.
Yeah, it's got to be cultural.
Yeah.
It's got to be top down. It's got to be cultural, and it's got to be practiced.
Yeah.
And it's got to be practiced in moments when it doesn't really matter, so that when it does come to an opportunity where it really could matter, the pressure's not on it, you know, and the exercise of let's come up with a crazy idea, they're getting even more crazy and wild and different and surprising. And then, you know, you marry it with whatever the constraints are and or the objectives of whatever the project is. And the ability to throw things out and edit things. Like, think about back in, like, high school, like, when we had to write a paper, you know, and you have to write a new draft of it because you had to do the final draft, or even moments where maybe you lost it. You know, I'm sure we all had the moment where you're almost done. We were almost done with the paper, and then the computer shut down and it didn't save. Right. And you're like, ah! But usually when you went back and you tried to do what was from memory, it was usually more concise, more clear, more powerful. So creating the conditions too in the corporate world for that kind of the faith that trying more things, trying it differently, something will always generate, even if it ends up landing on the original product, the original idea, the exploration of the other is probably going to still refine that and elevate it or make it even better.
Yeah, absolutely. So you've played in the hyper creative space, Broadway, through all of your Disney, those experiences, and the business school, the experience in Deloitte. So also the very practical, like tangible. How do those two sides of you coexist?
You know what? I left Deloitte a few weeks ago, and as I spend a bit of time getting crystal clear on who I am and what my value proposition, it's actually pretty easy, because my realization was that I decided to look at my resume instead of looking at, like, chronologically, looking at it as a spectrum. On the far left is art and design and creativity, and the far right is business. Mm-hmm. I started my career as far on the left as you can go. You know, I went to art and creative, you know, performing school, and then, you know, made money in that craft and that world, and then business school, and Deloitte doesn't get any further to the right than that. And then as I looked at the portfolio of my experiences, instead of chronologically, if I place them on that spectrum in terms of, okay, this role at Disney, how far was it on the creative side, you know, was it further, was it more creative or was it more business? And plotting each of those, I was able to see, oh, wow, my portfolio is pretty evenly spread across this entire spectrum. And how many people can say that? And as a result of having experiences, not just on the extremes of both sides, but being at points in between where I've had to navigate, marry, negotiate the push-pull of creative needs and business needs in order to maximize the ultimate value, that's my sweet spot. And actually, that's what excites me. If you go back to me in the basement creating the Wizard of Oz puppet show, having constraints, having vision, and then how do I ultimately, given the creativity and the objective, how do I come up with something really cool in the middle? And my hope is that, not just my hope, I think if I were to give myself any credits, it's probably pretty true that there's not a lot of people out in the world like me that have done both sides, but also almost every point in between, who has sat in those finance, you know, the finance meetings for a Broadway show and talked about, okay, what do we have to get rid of in order to make this set more profitable as we tour it across the country because it's really expensive? Yeah. What is the push-pull there creatively versus, you know, bang for your buck kind of stuff? But then also on the other side of it, you know, working in experiential marketing agencies and stuff like that, what is the push-pull there with creativity versus your business objectives and what a client wants to see?
Yeah. Well, and I think it's such a unique experience to have had experiences on either side of that spectrum, and also to have appreciation and, like, reverence is the word that's coming to mind, for both.
Yeah.
Because I think you are not, sometimes, you know, I find I'll fall into a trap of, oh, like, I don't want to be, like, on the analytical side of my brain. Like, I want to only be in the creative side.
Yeah.
Or, like, oh, I'm in the analytical side right now. We don't have time for any of that creative stuff. And I think the more you can try to have those, like, coexist in harmony and appreciate them for each what they are, and, like, almost have them working together as a team, I think that's such an incredible skill and can serve as like a translator across people that, you know, maybe it is hard for them to turn on both sides.
Yeah. It comes back to faith and trust. Mm-hmm. I don't know if it was Plato or Socrates or Steve Jobs. It was one of them that, you know, there's some quote about like art without science is, you know, weak or not as strong as it could be. And science without art is also equally weak. It's the balance of the two where we create the most value. And you think about a Steve Jobs, that he, you know, very much, you know, toed the line across the two.
Yeah.
The reason why Apple is so successful is because there's such a strong design element about it that just makes it more than just a technology company. It's a lifestyle company. It's an aesthetic company, et cetera. But it's also creating so much value for the world. I think Bob Iger has been so successful for the same reasons. He's a creative man. He understands, has reference for the creative side of things, understands the value of it, but also understands that, okay, that's cute and all, but we've got to make money. Mm-hmm. You know, we can't go broke because you want to cover Elsa's gown in, you know, Swarovski crystals, and the gown is going to cost, you know, $100,000. So I think some of the most successful people out there are those who are able to have reverence for both sides.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. Maybe to wrap up, I am curious how your views have changed on creativity, having gone through multiple experiences now.
I think that in some ways, just because you say you're an artist doesn't make you creative. And just because you're a business person, your business doesn't mean you're not creative.
Yeah.
I think there's a lot of business people who do really creative things in their approach and how they solve problems that's far more creative. Learn how to practice creativity. If you are a leader, really think about how, if you want to bring in people with creative backgrounds, you have to accommodate them too. You can't bring in, I think just like when people are talking about creating more diverse workforces, well, with diversity of cultures, race, whatever, come different approaches to living life that are just different. No one's is right, no one's is wrong, but you have to take any kind of diversity you bring into your company, you have to also think about, okay, cool, we're bringing in a different point of view. We also have to be ready to accommodate that and to expand our own minds and change our own approaches, because ultimately diversity of thought creates really interesting products if you're willing to accept the diversity.
Diversity of all types, yeah, too. It's just because you're hitting the quota, then you also need to.
Yeah.
Change the culture in a way that's accepting.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So for leaders, think about that. If you want to bring in somebody, don't just bring them in because they have a different background and you can flash it to stakeholders to impress them. But how are we actually going to use this? And are we prepared to use this? And have we created a culture of creativity, of being agile, of collaboration, of trial and error, of rewarding trying new things and making it safe for people to try something without it having to be successful. Mm-hmm. So
yeah,
just a few of my thoughts.
I love it. Thank you so much, Jeff.
Yeah.
I appreciate you being here.
My pleasure.
Hope you enjoyed my episode with Jeff Metzler.
Let me know what you thought of it and what lessons you took away by leaving a comment on the Lessons in Creativity Instagram page. Thanks so much, and stay tuned for more lessons.